Greetings, everyone, and good morning. It's Richard Solomon, Taking Care of Business, coming to you live at 88.1 FM, WCWP, WCWP.org, TCBRadio.com, TCBRadio.mypodcast.com, iTunes, TCB Radio, and a lot of other things. We have a great show for you today because we're going to be hitting the issues. We had such momentum from the Tax Revolt show that we're going to continue in the path of real estate right now. So I have a panel of real estate people. So I have all kinds of very, very cool people with me today. First of all, I have Paul Solomon, who's a real estate attorney and happened to know him pretty well.
Good morning, everyone. And also don't forget to check out tcbradio.mypodcast.com.
All right. And title attorney, Stephen Hamill.
Hey, guys. How's everything going?
And he has been a frequent guest co-host with us as well. And the show that we did with Airborne Ranger Gary Dolan was a great show. So,
thank you.
Great shout out there.
You too.
And, of course, we have today's expert, Robert G. Meyer, who is with Greenback Capital. And it's important that it's Greenback Capital as opposed to rubber check capital. All right. So let's just start up the show with the following. We're broadcasting here. If you have questions and you'd like to make a comment or a follow-up, you can send us an email to tcbradio, WCWP at yahoo.com. But if you want to talk to a real expert, we'd only end up forwarding the message to him anyway. It is rgm at greenbackcapital.com. And, of course, their website is greenbackcapital, that's T-A-L, capital.com. U.S. Dot U.S. There you go. All right. So both of them, .com and .us?
One is .com. The other is .us.
All right. GreenbackCapital.us for Uncle Shlomo. Okay. So there we go. All right. So today's topic is what's wrong with the way regulation is dealing with real estate that's causing problems? Why don't you grab the floor?
There's a number of different issues, Rich. Let me ask you a question.
Oh, I hate answering questions.
Say you're a bank, okay, and you're lending your money. You're the bank and you're lending money.
It's my money.
It's your money and you get to lend it.
Could I quote Daffy Duck? my, give me, give me, give me. I'm a rich, greedy miser.
So, Rich, the question that I would pose to you is you have a borrower, two borrowers, buying the same property, and one borrower is prepared to put down 50%.
Okay.
So the price of the house is $400,000, and they're prepared to put down
200 large,
and their credit is exemplary. They've never paid a bill late in their life, and all of the money is in their bank account.
Something tells me that the government is going to punish them.
You are
successful.
You're a very, very smart man, Rich.
Okay.
You see where I'm going with
and
this.
And choice number two.
Choice number two is somebody with very mediocre credit. Say a credit score maybe 630, 640, 650.
Just so our audience knows, could you just explain the credit score scale because people may not be familiar with that?
Credit scores generally range anywhere from a low of, say, 500 to a high of, say, 800. 800 being platinum, 500 being nobody is interested in talking with
copper.
You. what is considered an excellent score today is anything 740 and above, 720 and above, even 700 and above, which used to be considered platinum. Platinum is now just considered more like silver or gold. But, for example, the example I was giving before was somebody with a platinum credit score that had perhaps an 800 credit score, was putting down 50% and had $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 in the bank that was being verified. But they wanted to take out for a loan for $200,000, and they happened to be self-employed. Maybe they started their business 2, 3, 4 years ago, and it's a business where blah, blah, blah. Let's just say for the sake of argument that everything...
They're in the radio business.
Exactly, exactly. So that is client number one. Client number two has a very low credit score, 630, 640 by today's standards, really not so wonderful. They're prepared to put down 3.5%, and the 3.5% that they're putting down is not even their own money.
Right, they're getting a gift, right?
They're getting a gift from somebody, their brother-in-law, their brother, their cousin, their mother, their father, et cetera, et cetera. Also, all the closing costs are being paid by the seller on this particular deal. So you have a buyer who's coming in paying $400,000 for the same house, because these two people are competing bids. You have the person that's offering 50% down, and you have the person that's offering 3.5% down. Now, the person offering 3.5% down has a job, okay? They work for ABC Laundry, okay? And they've been there for 4 years.
The money laundry?
The money laundry is
the other guy. That's Clay. That's a guy with the 50% down. No, just kidding. Just kidding.
That's very funny.
Yeah, I try to make it light because everybody's still waking up out there. Good morning.
So now again, we're back to square one, which is Rich. You're lending your money. Now, who would you rather lend the money to?
The lowest risk.
Well, who in your mind is the lowest risk? The man who's putting down 50%, it's all his own money, 800 credit score, verifying everything, or the fellow who's really has no stake in the deal whatsoever, putting down 3.5% all gift money, the closing costs are all being paid by the seller, but he has a job. He makes $70,000 a year working for the ABC Laundry, let's say.
Well, here's the thing. I know that from the world of venture capital that they always ask one question when you have an idea, a new business. They go, how much of your money is in this deal? Because they want to see skin in the game. They want to see real commitment. Sort of like a breakfast example. They say, well, you have steak and eggs. See, the chicken participated, but the steak is committed. it's different. It's like a different. Mm. So I would like to see somebody who's committed. So when you're halfway in, the amount that you would lose, you'd lose half your equity if you go into foreclosure. That's $200,000. Your credit would be shot, and you'd lose all that equity. The other people have so much less risk that if the deal goes south, they could just say, you know what? I got nothing in. I might as well leave the sinking ship now while the leaving is good before I start putting more money into it.
Well,
this.
So I guess you could technically say that the person that was buying for the $400,000 has no stake in it. You say you would like to see people committed.
Oh, I want the steak, not the eggs.
Actually, wouldn't you say that the person making the loan for the 3.5% down should be committed?
Oh, yeah, they should. Well, they should be, but that's...
Do you know who's making that 3.5% down loan today?
FHA?
FHA.
Oh, how could I? What a lucky guess.
Because
I've done litigation on not security deposits, but the down payment.
Yes.
Because I've had a number of cases recently where people have put their, quote, down payments down, and they were mediocre, small, in comparison to the deal. There were small percentages. And sure enough, somehow the deal doesn't come through, or what happened was probably more likely the market tanked, and they were like, you know what? Let me get out now, and then I'll just sue for my money back, because I would rather sue for the $20,000, whatever it is, on that money than to really go through the whole thing.
Yeah, Rich, the point that I'm trying to make here is that the developments in the market have created a lending criteria that really defies any kind of logic whatsoever.
And what's the wrong behavior?
What's happening now is everyone brings up the fact that the no income check, the stated income loans, and for anybody who's not familiar with stated income, also referred to quote unquote, as many people call them, liar loans, loans where you don't have to document what you actually make, and the bank accepts it because, A, you have good credit, you have this, you have that. You have all the factors that lead a lender to say that you're not going to default on this particular property. But what's happening now is the government has come out with new regulations that have basically chased everybody out of the no-income check market. So now you have people that are literally putting down 50%, 60%, 70%, 80% that may be self-employed, that for whatever reason, they have a lot of write-offs, this or that. They don't necessarily show everything on a 1040 form, or they defer it, or they do something other than that.
Right, because they have aggressive tax people behind them.
Those people who are putting down these tremendously large down payments and have shown that they have the ability to pay and do pay their bills on time are being cut out of the market. Now, this is a decent segment of the market. This is a market that could create more home sales, but due to the Dodd-Frank bill, which is coming down the pike and I think goes into effect within the next 2 or 3 months, Dodd-Frank has stated that every single loan that gets done in this country requires tax returns, requires income to be verified fully. So I want to go back to the example that we started with, which was Rich. Would you prefer to lend somebody with 3.5% down or 50% down?
50% because I'm halfway done with getting my money back.
Exactly. But that's not the reality of what's going on today. The government continues to lend based on 3.5% down, and essentially people that are buying are underwater from the day that they close on this particular house. We already have 11 million homes that are underwater in this country, and we're adding to that on a daily basis. And it's a huge, huge problem that's being developed and with what's going on.
All right, let me talk to the real estate lawyers here. What do you see out there? Do you see this is sort of the banking, but do you see this from the real estate law perspective, either one of you?
I know. I'm looking at Paul, and he's just agreeing. You know, I think we're both thinking the same thing here.
I have done FHA loans, and I've always seen the insanity behind them, because if somebody is only putting down 3.5%, they could walk away from the property. They have no tie to this property. They're not invested in it, and then it becomes the taxpayer's headache.
Well, not only that, but what ends up happening is if there's a default, the bank has to go through the whole process of, because I've been through foreclosures as a defendant, not personally, of course, but on behalf of clients. So I've got to make sure it works that clear. But what happens is you go to like one of the foreclosure parts, like in Brooklyn, it's like on the 7th floor, the end of the Supreme Court, all the way back towards, I guess it's by where the hotel side of it is, as opposed to the front part. And I forgot. And there's a part where there's nothing but foreclosures. It's all the same lenders. Things get adjourned. They're there forever. And I'm wondering, who's paying the taxes, the insurance? If people aren't paying their bills and it's in foreclosure and the bank hasn't yet taken the property, all this stuff is at risk for all kinds of things, including loss of theft and fire and whatever. So you see that. You see, When they do a foreclosure, just so people know, everybody who has an interest in the property gets named. That's always the city, the Environmental Control Board, parking violations, the water people, lenders, mechanics liens, everybody's sort of – so foreclosure is a gigantic disaster because it's sort of like a ship that sinks a lot of people with it.
But today that's not even like the biggest issues, because you have so much downward pressure in the market because of all these properties that are, you know, simply available. You know, you're chasing the values down the hill.
Well, what is real estate declining at right now? Is it like 4% a year or something like that? What's the statistic?
I haven't heard the recent number, but
what was the last thing you heard?
The last I heard was 4%. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what should be done?
Well,
because in this show here, we had two real estate lawyers. One of them was Jeffrey Mazel and his law partner, and four co-op presidents, including the presidents of Glen Oaks, Bay Terrace, Clearview, and
Glen Oaks Village.
Glen Oaks, Clearview, Bay Terrace, and maybe it was three. Yeah, okay, whatever. And we did a great show. We did a great show on what was going on. And the tax revolt home started here. They produced a number of CDs out of the show. We passed it around, got politicians involved, put a lot of pressure on them. Maybe we need to do the real estate revolt here.
Well, you're asking what can be done, and I think what needs to be done is to allow banks, and we're not talking about the big five banks, We're not talking about the big five banks. We're talking about, and everybody knows who the big five banks are, or if you don't, then, you know, you can Google them and see who the big five banks are. There's a lot of mid-cap banks that never got involved in the subprime mess, that had a good, clean portfolio. Am I allowed to mention particular banks here? I mean, one bank that I used to do business with was M&T Bank. And M&T Bank had a very, very good program up until about last year, which was they were offering a home equity line of credit where they would give a moderate line to somebody who had good equity in a property. They might lend them up to $50,000 or $100,000 without going through the usual rigmarole of checking all the documents that the bank would normally check. If they saw that the credit was good and this and that, they would say, okay, we feel that we have a good position here. We're going to make a business decision. And that business decision is that these people are very, very capable of handling $50,000 home equity line of credit, and we're going to give them that money. As these new rules came out with the Federal Reserve and Dodd-Frank and all the bad publicity about stated income loans came out, banks started to shy away through the threat of potential litigation because they're going against a law that's down the pike, and they don't want to get involved in that. It's not worth it to them. So one of the things that can be done is to relax, start to look at the logic of what you're putting in place, and I'm talking about the federal government, what they're putting in place, and how it's preventing lenders from making good quality business decision. That quality of a business decision has essentially been taken out of the hands of banks that used to make decisions for themselves.
All right, you are listening to Taking Care of Business, WCWP 88.1 FM, Brookville, New York. The show is Taking Care of Business. I am co-hosted by some fine, fine people. My brother, Paul Solomon, attorney at law, real estate lawyer. Stephen J. Hamill, attorney and professor.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Did we see you at Gilligan's Island? You must have gotten like a couple of coconuts. And more importantly, our guest, Robert G. Meyer.
Don't leave out the nickname.
The Mortgage Messiah. Should I say that like more deep? The Mortgage Messiah.
I think you could go an octave lower.
The Mortgage Messiah.
I like that.
That's right. You know, of greenback cap. Now, I know I mentioned this every once in a while on the radio, but I always thought that the funniest thing I ever saw, ever in a movie, was when Mel Brooks was doing History of the World Part 1. And he's dressed like Charlton Heston from the Ten Commandments. And he comes down. He's wearing the red robe. He's got the beard. And he's talking to God. And God says, give thy people thy law. And he says, I'll do that. And he comes down with all these tablets. And he goes, I've seen God. He's given us thy law. And he's given us these... whoa. And you see like one tablet falls over, blinks into 5,000 pieces. And he goes, 10 commandments. Which shows that Moses really thought fast on his feet.
You know, but when you're talking about these 10 commandments, it's really a good transition because you got to ask yourself what the function of government is. And I think, you know, as you're talking about this, you have to say, what is government's purpose? Is it simply to regulate, or is it to do policy decisions that they feel that they want to influence? And in this case, it doesn't necessarily appear to me that these are just regulatory things, but they're almost policy-driven choices.
Micromanagement.
And through the policy choices, they're changing the business dynamic. And it's a shift from when our founding fathers first started this republic and to what we're doing now. You know, it's really a shift, and that's how I see it. I don't know if you guys disagree with me, but...
No, I agree. First of all, where in the Constitution does it say the government has the right to make a loan? I don't think that's an extra constitutional activity. I don't think the government has that right.
Well, see, what's even more interesting is, you know, as a corporate lawyer, I always talk about the business judgment rule in the context of litigation, which is, you can't really criticize anybody if they use business judgment, and their business judgment that seemed to make good sense. All right, we bought it because under our business judgment, we thought it was a good idea. But when government tells you what your business judgment should be, all of a sudden, people who are not in business are telling you what your business is, and I think that is what is greatly offensive to business people. Same way, why do the bankers need to be told what the bankers are expert at banking? They are experts in making money, assessing risk, and doing what they do. And all of a sudden, you're telling people then if the government really doesn't like the way banks work, then they really should just create a special pool for like high risk loans or something like that, and just do it themselves, but still not interfere with.
Rich, I wanted to just interject something there. They have created a high risk pool for high risk loans. It's called the FHA.
All right. Well, but okay. So there you go.
You know, that's at 3.5% down. We're still doing the point that I was making to begin with was that we're not doing any better now than we were 5 years ago before the entire financial meltdown began. And we're still making the same errors that we were 5 years ago. Now, I'm a mortgage broker, so I make my living on doing FHA loans and also doing conventional and some of the – there are two banks left that I'm aware of.
In New York State or just the United States?
Well, I know from New York – we do New York. We do New Jersey. We do Florida, the states that I'm familiar with, and I know many other people in the business that do more than three states. And as far as I know, there are really only about two, maybe three banks left that are doing any kind of no income or stated income check loan. Emigrant was in the stated income business up until about 2 months ago, and they dropped out because they felt that the legislation was just becoming too heavy-handed, and they weren't going to start litigating every loan that they were doing. So they were a viable lender that were making common sense loans that were anywhere from 45% down to 60% down in many cases.
Yeah,
and those were the loans that they were making. They were getting a good return on their money, and people that were taking those loans were happy to get those particular loans. But they left the stated income business simply because the pressure became too great on them. There are two banks left that we still deal with, but every week that goes by, I say, are those programs still going to be there, you know, in a couple of weeks? I mean, and when you look at it, not from a speaking very, very candidly, from a realistic point of view, you have many, many communities in the New York area, like the Chinese community. You have other similar communities, the Korean community, that do deal. Let's call it the way it is. They have cash businesses, and do we want to deny these people the opportunity to buy a home? Keep in mind that we have a real estate market that's sinking, and we're taking viable people who are prepared to put a great deal of money down on a particular house. We're saying to them, you're not eligible for a loan, but we're going to give it to the person who's competing for the same house with 3.5% down, but you're putting 80% down, you're not getting the loan. The person with the 3.5% is.
So basically those people are being forced to just buy an all-cash deal, essentially.
If they have all of the cash, but many times it's not all cash, and they do need some kind of mortgage financing. But if you're trying to repair a real estate market, you do it by making effective decisions to repair that market. Is it an effective business decision to say, you've got great credit, you pay your bills on time, but we're not giving you a loan because you don't meet the parameters that we're looking for you to meet? And again, if I'm lending my own money, would I prefer to lend to somebody who's putting down 60%? Of course I would. It's a no-brainer, as they say.
Oh, absolutely. So, but what can people do to, you know, people always say, well, what can I do? I'm just one person. What can people do? I know with the tax revolt, we actually had a very interesting thing because people were highly motivated because the potential tax increase to the co-op and condo residents that we addressed in the show was like 152% in 1 year, which was just catastrophic. And then the city of New York said something like, all right, well, we'll phase it over 2 years. I'm like, oh, good. So it's only 75% 1 year and the other 77% the next year. But we put just enormous pressure on people. We threatened litigation. It was just the amount of people calling and complaining, the press that was received in the newspaper media, like the local newspapers, like the Bayside Times and the Queens Gazette, and all those types of papers really got a lot of traction. The Daily News and a lot of other, you know, more mainstream, bigger papers covered it too. So there was just this overwhelming surge that the politicians and the lawmakers had to yield to. How do we do that here? What do we do? What should we tell people to do?
You know, that's a very, very big and complete question. And as far as what we can do, I suppose, you know, you can call your local politician. You can, I mean, I'll give you
one. Is this more of a federal thing? Is this something you got to call your senators?
It's both federal and local. I'll give you an example. Let's take it to a local level so it makes it a little bit easier, perhaps, for people to address it rather than going to a federal level. We live in New York State. When you buy a home, say, in the city of New York, you have a little thing that you have to pay called New York State mortgage tax.
Now, how much is that?
It's generally, Steve, what is it, 1.8%?
It depends on the amount, the type of property.
But it's about 2%.
Yeah, it's a substantial amount of money.
I'm going to round it off and say it's 2%. In some cases, it can even be more than 2% because what people don't realize is the bank actually kicks in 0.25% too. So usually what happens is the borrower pays 1.8% and then the bank pays 0.25%. So you're looking at 2%, 2.05% on a transaction. Now, if somebody in New York State is taking out a mortgage for $500,000, that's $10,000 in mortgage tax. So say
that's a little bit of a damper.
You're not kidding. Rich, say you bought a house last year, and rates were a little bit high last year. They were 6.5%. By today's standards, that's high. But you bought the house, and now you've got a rate of 6.5%, and you want to go to refinance it.
Right, because I can get 4.9%.
Now you can get 4.9%. Well, what the state says to you is you can, you know, no problem. You could go to any bank you want, but you're still going to have to pay New York State mortgage tax when you go to refinance your loan. So even though you just paid a little over $10,000 when you bought the house
in
mortgage tax, it's not enough. Now you're refinancing, and you've got to go back, and you're going to pay us again. And by the way, if you ever want to refinance again, you'll pay it again and again and again. Now, the interesting thing is that there is a caveat in the law that allows you to not have to pay the mortgage tax. It's something called consolidation, extension, modification, and those are used quite frequently. So there are loopholes, but in order to obtain that loophole, you've got to pay out what can sometimes be $2,000, $2,500 just to avoid paying the mortgage tax.
Well, a substantial delay and possible rejection of the documents. Note is missing, something's wrong, and then you can't do it.
Right.
You know what it is? It's they grab you by the ankles and they keep shaking, and even though like 10 bucks comes out, they really want 25.
So yeah, but there's other hidden taxes. You got mansion tax, you know, 1%, you know, if you're on the Peconic Bay region or if you're on the East End. Plus, you know, when you sell it, you got transfer tax, you know, both on the state and the city level. You know, so these are, I guess, really hidden taxes, I would classify them as. Most people aren't aware of them until they go into the transaction. You know, but there have to be limits. There have to be limits when people stop saying, you know, people start saying, I'm not going to do this. Either it's a bank conducting business or people investing in real estate. You know, when do you reach those limits?
Well, I guess what was kind of interesting is for the government, this was just giant cash because when the real estate market was super hot, they were making money on the buying, the selling, the mortgage tax, the property tax, the this, the that.
The recording charges, the deeds, exactly. The mortgages, sats, assignments, everything.
In the meantime, if you go across the river.
Okay, wait. It is almost 29 minutes after, so what we have to do is we have to take a mandatory hard break, so we'll be right back after this. Don't go anywhere at all. All right, and we're back. Thanks for hanging in here. This is Taking Care of Business. Richard Solomon, Steve Hamill, Paul Solomon, your co-host today. We're talking about why real estate policy is I didn't forget you.
I thought you were
No. You saved the best
for I was starting to say a little
bit. We're talking about real estate policy with our expert guest, Robert G. Meyer.
All right, because
there you go.
I like to see the phone.
All right, so 516-672-0333. So we're going to – this is what you got to copy down with those pencils out there. And I know everybody has a tablet. No one has pencils anymore. It is Robert G. Meyer, the Mortgage Messiah. He is at RGM at greenbackcapital.com. And the website is greenbackcapital.us.
One other website?
Sure.
TheMortgageMessiah at gmail.com.
All right. And for
that's Messiah with two S's.
That's right. All right, good. M-E-S-S-I-A-H. Because if you don't know what you're doing, you will get into a mess. All right.
And so, I did get rabbinical approval for that, of course.
All right. Because you've answered to a higher authority.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, sort of like...
it's not just for hot dogs.
we were at a picnic like a couple of weekends ago, and we had some just phenomenal kosher hot dogs on the barbecue. It's just awesome. Anyway.
Do you ever have the chicken ones? The chicken ones are very good.
Oh, I get those at Whole Foods. All right. Anyway.
All right. We're getting into something serious here.
All roads lead to food.
So, Rich,
you go across the river.
Go across the river. You go to New Jersey, and you don't have to deal with something like a New York mortgage tax. So the closing costs on that same $500,000 loan could be $10,000 or $10,000 less than they would be in New York. Now, New York obviously needs the money, so we don't want to take the mortgage tax away from them entirely. So my proposal would be the following. Leave the mortgage tax alone for people that are buying. But when you have somebody that's refinancing and all they want to do is reduce their interest rate, get out of their way. Put some kind of a moratorium in place for 2 years, 3 years. See how it works out. Many times, probably 50 to 70% of the time, New York's not getting the money anyway because people are doing what I alluded to earlier. They're going for CEMAs. But the CEMAs put extra money in the bank's pockets, in the attorney's pockets. Forgive me.
That's all right. We make our money all kinds of ways.
But if I was, to make that proposal for people that are just reducing their interest rate, get off their backs. Let them reduce their rate. Let them have a lifestyle. I have seen people prevented from refinancing because we could not get a CEMA, and they had to pay an extra $10,000 for the mortgage tax, and that extra $10,000 that they had to pay made it not worthwhile to go through with the refinance.
I remember what Ronald Reagan said. He says, you got to get government off the backs of the people. And I think this is clearly an example of that.
Well, what did Reagan say? He said government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem. And in this case, you know, if the greed made sense and the money was actually flowing into the coffers of New York State most of the time, I guess you could make an argument for it. The state is desperate for the money and they'll do whatever they can to get it. But in this particular case, most of the time, they're not getting the money anyway. It puts people through an intense amount of paperwork and everything else to get that consolidation document. And in the end, it prevents a lot of people that need to lower their interest rates from lowering it. So getting back to your initial question was, what can we do? We could attack this one issue in New York. We could talk to our congresspeople. We could say, not our congresspeople, but our assembly people and our state senators, and say, you know what? Put in a 2-year moratorium on the New York State mortgage tax only for people that are refinancing and only for the amount that's currently owed. That's it. If you're taking out cash, so if you're taking out $100,000 more than you presently owe, by all means, we'll give you your mortgage tax. But just for the amount that we currently owe, leave us alone. Let me do what the people in New Jersey can so freely do.
So New Jersey does not have any mortgage tax?
No mortgage tax. And from what I understand, there's very few states in the country that even have a mortgage tax at all. Somebody told me that Oklahoma has one. But based on the prices, and I think it's 0.25%, You know, there may be a couple of others out there, but I don't know.
I just had an intern hand me the actually, I just Googled it. but let's pretend. I just had an intern give me the following information. The governor's office of the state of New York is 518-474-8390. Call them. Call them and complain. Let's say, because Andrew Cuomo is the current governor right now, and he seems to be, you know, at least in listening mode so far. So give him a call, 518-474-8390. He is at the New York State Capitol, C-A-P-I-T-O-L building, Albany, New York, 12224. And, you know, let's start sending some letters and making some phone calls. So 518-474-8390. I'm sure that if people paid less tax, there were more money in their pocket, they would spend more money, and then New York State would make it up on the sales tax.
And isn't that the case that here you have a situation that New York's onerous tax is preventing people, many people, from refinancing, and by refinancing, they would be lowering their interest rate, putting more money in their pocket. They all live in New York State. Where are they going to be spending that extra money? Just a small thing that's not so small that could go a long way to helping New York's economy.
So what other policies out there need a little bit of fine tuning? About the mansion?
Another big one, and actually I think one of the biggest of all is something called HVCC, which was created by our illustrious governor. And Governor Cuomo pressured Fannie Mae some 2, 3, 4 years ago that the appraisals that were being done were not satisfactory. They weren't the brokers were ordering them, the bankers were ordering them, and the appraisers that were going out to appraise the properties weren't independent enough. I will tell you that if I found one thing from a point of view that really hasn't worked and has so hurt the consumer, this HVCC, which stands for the Home Valuation Code of Conduct. It's a code of conduct that every appraiser needs to go by today, and it's a form of insanity to call it to say exactly the way it is. And I'll give you one quick example. I went to, can I mention a bank's name here?
Yeah.
Okay.
We have no sponsors.
I had a client that we put through Bank of America. Bank of America then takes it to their management company. By the way, an appraisal, a simple appraisal, used to cost $300, $325. Now they can cost as much as $470, $500. I've even seen them cost over $600 for a basic appraisal. Because HVC corrected the system by giving the banks even more business. What's happened here is that all of the appraisals have to go through management companies. Who do you think owns those management companies?
Who?
Take a guess.
Federal government?
No.
The real estate industry?
The banks.
Oh, so it's like the left arm and the right arm.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. The banks own the management companies.
That manage the bank.
That manage the appraisal. And that's supposed to correct the system. So just to give you an example, we had a deal that went through Bank of America. And we sent it over to Bank of America, and the property, which is in Oceanside, New York, appraised out for $510,000. This was a very, very gorgeous house. We all agreed that the appraisal was kind of ridiculous coming in at 510.
What, it was too low?
It was way too low in this particular case. So what we had to do was, because it's very, very hard to challenge these appraisals once they're in, we had to change banks, okay? So we sent it, again, I can mention the other bank. We sent it to Sovereign Bank. Okay, Sovereign Bank went through their management company. Their appraiser went out there, appraised it for $590,000. The same exact house, 1 week later. How does that happen?
Scaffolding. Paint.
But you know, I'm not to be the wet rag here, but I would say that there have been abuses in the marketplace.
No question.
You know,
no question.
And some. I'm sure none of this would have gone on in your offices, but. There have been inappropriate things that happened, and because of the various levels of insurance and governmental programs, that the government does have a substantial governmental interest in making sure that that the proper things do go on. Maybe the pendulum hit the other side of the wall in certain areas, but I don't think you can simply just dismiss the legitimate governmental
interest. And Steve, that's a very, very good point. So which is the correct appraisal then? Is the 510 correct or is the 590 correct?
I don't know. Well, it's a diminishing – I mean, it's like chasing – like I said earlier, it's like chasing a ball down the hill right now.
Well, again, these are both done at virtually the same time. So if there was a year apart between the appraisals, you could make an argument. But when they're 1 week apart, you really can't make that type of an argument. This is only one example that I'm giving you. I mean, there's other examples where they're $200,000 apart. We had one in New Jersey that the one bank appraised for $720,000 and the other one appraised for $920,000. I mean, it's crazy stuff. The biggest part of it, though, as a broker, I used to have portability of an appraisal, which meant that the appraisal was assigned to me. If Bank A decided that they, for whatever reason, didn't want to do the loan, I could move that appraisal to Bank B or Bank C or Bank D. Now, if Paul, you apply for a mortgage, and we try to do it with Bank A, and Bank A refuses you, you're out the money for your appraisal. If we go to Bank B, we have to do a brand new appraisal, a second appraisal, which you're going to have to pay for again.
Even if it's the same person appraising it?
It's not going to be the same person appraising it because every bank has – it's not a uniform thing that's going on here. Every bank has their own management company. Wells Fargo has a company called RELS. Bank of America has LandSafe. This one has this company. This one has this company. And none of the companies talk to each other. So what winds up happening if a bank – and it's happened many times. Bank A doesn't like the loan. They deny the loan. We go to Bank B. They do the loan. But in this case, the consumer has to pay twice.
Now, why is the federal government so concerned with the appraisal? Because if the bank finds it acceptable, why should the government care?
Well, you got to recognize that probably 90 to 95% of the loans that are being done in this country right now are government-backed loans, either FHA, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. There's very, very few portfolio lenders anymore because the government has monopolized the market. But the thing here is that, and I can tell you this from real firsthand experience working with it, that every time the government comes up with another rule, it winds up costing the consumer more, not less. And that's a problem. We went from $300 for an appraisal to $470, $500 for the same appraisal because now the management company has to get their cut.
You are listening to Taking Care of Business, TCBRadio.com. Maybe at the end we'll put a CLE code for this. We'll make they'll submit this for a CLE on real estate policy because it is being conducted by three attorney instructors. So there you go. So we'll put a code at the end of this. By the way, if you do want to make a complaint to your United States senators, the senator phone numbers for the New York State Senate people are 202-224-4451 and 202-224-6542. And of course, you can always Google Firefox or Bing or whatever it is that people do to use on searches. But they definitely, you've got to start taking action. We can't really just be sitting back there and taking it on the chin anymore.
Now, there's one other thing that I wanted to add to this that's very, very important. The individual appraiser's fees have been cut down substantially. An appraiser maybe in the past was paid $200 for going out to do an appraisal. That individual appraiser may be working on half that these days. There is an old adage, you get what you pay for. And what that means in this particular case is guy wants to get in and out as quickly as possible. He may not, and there's very, very good, and I'm not saying this to impugn any of the very, very good appraisers that are out there, but guys don't have the time. If they're getting paid $100 for an appraisal report, they need to get in and they need to get out, and they may miss data simply because they don't have the time to spend. They've got to get to the next appraisal, which wind up with these huge swings when you actually get to see two appraisals on the same property. There's other issues with this too. I mean, one of the big issues simply is I can no longer communicate with an appraiser. I'm not allowed to talk to appraisers anymore. The real estate business, the mortgage business, is such a the need for communication is so intense that you really need to be able to communicate with lawyers, with real estate brokers, with the appraisers, et cetera, in order to do a effective job in representing your client. In this case, it would be the borrower. If I can't talk to an appraiser to discuss comparables that he may have missed, it leads to less efficiency, not more efficiency. Let me ask you questions, Paul. Let's say you are you want to refinance your house.
Okay.
And we want to get an approximate value because no one can ascertain today, based on the changing environment in real estate, what your house is going to be worth. You bought it for $600,000, hypothetically, in 2004. We want to do a rate reduction refinance, and we need it to be – it's got to be worth $550 in order for us to complete that rate reduction. Not a cash out, just a rate reduction refinance in order to complete that properly. I can't even tell you in advance whether we should proceed or not because I can no longer communicate with an appraiser. I used to be able to call up an appraiser on the phone and say, Mr. Appraiser, can you please look up the property and give me an idea where we would be as far as the value of this particular property. Based on that, Paul, I could tell you whether it's worth it for you to start spending money to commence your refinance or not. But since they took that away and the ability for me to communicate with the appraiser, I work blind. I have to physically take an entire application from you. I've got to take your tax returns, all your information, and after I've done all that, I submit it to the bank, and about a week to 10 days later, I'm allowed to order an appraisal. So in 2 weeks, you might find out what your property is worth. And if it's not worth $550 and it comes in at $535, you're not going to be able to do the refinance anyway. Wouldn't it have been nice to be able to pick up a phone and say, what do you feel the value is here?
And I guess you can't pre-order an appraisal.
You can't. Okay. You can't. These HVCC rules prevent you from communicating. And when you cut off communication, you cut off the ability of people like myself to serve consumers. We're not all – there's a lot of good mortgage brokers out there. Many of the people that are left in the industry are people that really do a good job and care. I'm consistently saving people money on a daily basis. I love saving people money. I love finding the little niche that works for somebody, because many times people go to a bank and they're declined and they come to me, and that's how I got my nickname, the Mortgage Messiah, because they used to say, and they still do, that I bring the dead deals back to life. So I did not name myself the Mortgage Messiah. I was given that name. And the fact of the matter is, communication is key to my serving clients. The more regulation that they put in my way, the less I get to communicate and the less I get to serve my clients.
But in fact, this environment that we find ourselves in now doesn't change. Where do we go from here? I mean, how are we able to function within this environment? Is it going to be the type of situation where the smaller guys are forced out and it's only left to the super large banks to process these loans?
Well,
I mean, is that where
we're
going?
You know what disturbed me the other day? I think it was June 7th that Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of Chase Bank, had an interaction with Ben Bernanke. And the terminology that he used in his interaction with Ben Bernanke, and I'm paraphrasing, was something the no good mortgage brokers are no longer in the business. They were all out of the business. And again, forgive me, I'm paraphrasing it, but mortgage brokers do a very effective job because we have the ability, in my particular case, my company, our company, we deal with 16 different lenders. If lender A doesn't fit, then we go to lender B. Many cases, we'd still do first and second mortgages for people to avoid something called mortgage insurance, which can be very expensive. I have 22 years experience. I bring all barrels to bear when a client comes to me to get them a great deal, to figure out how to avoid PMI insurance, how to get them the best financing possible. And regulation like the Federal Reserve recently came out with, regulation like the Dodd-Frank bill, which I don't think you allow the expletives that I'd like to use regarding that bill.
FCC compliant.
weren't some of these guys the same people who were involved in the original policies that led to these decisions?
Well, do you put everybody
not
into
to derail the conversation?
By the way, thanks, Steve, for all the for the devil's advocate role here. But do you put everybody into the same basket? If you have a half a dozen bad car dealers, are all car dealers bad? I mean, it gets to a point that you overregulate, you overreach, you overdo what you're trying to do, and in the process, you really, really hurt the consumer. And that's what's happening right now, and that's what's contributing to the downfall in the real estate market. They have so impaired our ability to work for the consumer that it has hurt the real estate market.
And because it's hurt the real estate market, it's hurt the title market, it's hurt the real estate lawyers, and all of the people
everything.
Right. And let's put it this way, at one point in the economy, real estate was a very strong and robust sector, and now it's in a very bad decline.
But it could be if you just allow it to – water seeks its own level. If you allow the real estate market just to seek its own level without all the government interference, yes, we're going to have a year or 2 years of tremendous pain, but it'll be over, and then the market will start to recover. And the thing is, every time another government program comes in, and some of these programs really do border on insanity with the modifications and everything else, banks are telling people, don't pay your mortgage, because if you pay your mortgage on time, you're not going to be able to modify your loan. So people intentionally don't pay their mortgages on time per instructions of somebody at the bank who told them off the record not to.
Well, I mean, these policies are in place, and as an attorney, you know, I do find that some of these policies are perhaps, you know, counterproductive for society. But if you have a client that comes to you with a certain set of facts, you have a duty to advise the client what's in the best interest of the client. And if that's simply walking away from a property, you know, and avoiding – even potentially avoiding the debt – like the 1099 issue, which was, you know, in the past you would get a 1099 for a deficiency, and that would be considered income. But now a lot of these times you can simply avoid that. How do you not advise your client to do what's best for your client, even if it's somehow?
Well, I think what Rob is trying to say is that we need the laws to change so that the industry can kind of loosen up and seek its own level.
Yeah,
because
there's no
right
doubt.
Right now as lawyers, we're faced with that dilemma.
Of course.
And that's what's killing the industry and bringing everything down and hurting lending and all these practices.
But it doesn't change the fact that we have to operate right now within this environment.
Right, but lawyers can be a force of change too.
Of course.
And so for all the lawyers out there who are listening, maybe you guys need to start motivating and making those phone calls and faxes and to the government, because it's in everybody's interest for the economy to improve.
Well, even like you said with the title business, in New York they were talking about the public option title insurance, you know, where they were proposed in Albany, where they're going to say, look, we'll just have it instead of having title insurance offered by independent companies, we'll have the state of New York offer title insurance. The whole environment in the real estate sector is changing. Even look at the truth in lending disclosures. You know, if anybody's prepared RESPAs lately, you know, the HUD statements with all the disclosure fees, that's radically changed also, you know, in regard to what fees can be disclosed, shouldn't be, certain parameters. You know, it's crazy.
And it's a shame as attorneys we have to be so careful about what we put on the HUD for fear of jeopardizing a closing, because I know that the banks are much strict with any changes to the HUD.
Well, here's, you know, you brought up the HUD, and that's a very interesting story.
We have 45 seconds, but then we'll come back. So
should I do my rendition of Melancholy Baby?
give us the sound bite that we're going to come back to.
I just lost my train of thought.
You're talking about HUD.
Oh, yeah.
All HUD
HUDs. Well, when we come back, we'll explain what HUD is. It stands for Housing and Urban Development. There is a form that they have created to tell people what their closing costs are so that they will be easily understandable, and we'll go into that as soon as we come back.
All right, so we'll be right back. You're listening to 88.1 FM. This is a hard break at 55 minutes after the hour. We're listening to Taking Care of Business. Richard Solomon, Paul Solomon, Steve Hamill, and Robert Meyer. So we didn't leave you out. All right. Steve Hamill and Paul Solomon are real estate attorneys. I'm Richard Solomon, a commercial small business attorney. But we're here with Robert G. Meyer, the vice president of Greenback Capital. We're your connection. That's their motto. RGM at greenbackcapital.com. greenbackcapital.us. And they are a registered mortgage broker, New York State Banking Department, licensed in New York, New Jersey. And for all other great information, 516-672-0333. One more time, 516-672-0333. All right, we only have 3 minutes minus a little bit. So let's
– where we left off, we were talking about the HUD, which is a document. It's called the HUD-1. And a HUD-1 is supposed to explain to the client who's closing what his closing costs were. About 2 years ago, they changed the HUD. The HUD went from basically a one-page form that was very, very simple to read. Everybody understood it. We knew. And they changed it to a three-page form that nobody knows what the hell is going on. The closing attorney doesn't know. I generally don't know. The buyer's attorney, the buyer certainly would be in the dark. This is, again, an overreach by the FHA. The FHA developed this form. They started working on it in 2005. They took something like 4 or 5 years to develop this three-page form that nobody understands. Paul, do you understand it?
Not the way I understood the old form. The old form was very easy.
Right.
The new form, you need explanations sometimes.
Right. So we have to be very, very logical. We have to look at things from a business perspective, how it's going to affect business. And when government puts a rule in effect, it can't just be because it's politically expedient. It's the flavor of the month to put that particular rule in place, i.e. what we spoke about at the beginning of the show, getting rid of the stated income loan is not a smart thing. If somebody's putting down 50-60%, you want that to be available to them.
All right. Well, a lightning round of information. If you need more information, you got to go to the source, go to the Mortgage Messiah, because he has CPR skills that that other people may not necessarily be aware of. So, in our closing, I would like to thank Steve Hamill for schlepping out and being here.
It's always my pleasure.
All right, Paul, always great to have you.
And thank you all for the emails.
All right, thank you. And, of course, Robert, thank you for being here. Robert G. Meyer, the vice president of Greenback Capital. We're going to close it out. We'll see you in a week. Look for us on the web. Let's see, tcbradio.com, iTunes, my podcast, tcbradio.mypodcast.com. Always here on 88.1 FM and, of course, at wcwp.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Take care.